როგორ ხართ, დღეს მაქვს ცოტა უცნაური სერია და ამიტომ გადავწყვიტე, რომ პატარა შესავალი ჩამეწერა, ინტერვიუ არის, რომელიც მოკლედ ორი რაღაცა გავაკეთე, რასაც არ ვაკეთებ ხოლმე როგორც წესი. ერთი ის, რომ ზუმით არის ჩაწერილი, ამიტომ ხარისხი ხმის არ არის ესეთი გადასარევი. მეორე არის ინგლისურად. საქმე იმაშია, რომ ცოტა ხნის წინ მქონდა სამი სერია საერთო სახელით სიმპათია ეშმაკების მიმართ და ამ სამივე სერიაში კარგად დავესესხე ერთ წიგნს, ფაბრიციო ფენგის წიგნს, რომელსაც ერქვა, ეხაც ქვია ეგრე, It will be fun and terrifying. და მე მორჩირა, მაგრამ ხაც კუჩაში რომ მიდიხარ, შენთვის რაღაცებს ვფიქრობ და ვიფიქრე, რომ ბარემ მივწერმეთქი ამ კაცს, სამი სერია გამიკეთებია მაგის წიგნზე დაყრდნობით და დალაპარაკება მინდოდა, მაინტერესებდა მისი აზრი რაღაცებთან დაკავშირებით. და ვიფიქრე, ბარემ სამსახური მაქვს ეგეთი, რა ვიცი, რატომაც არა დაურეკავ და ველაპარაკები პოდკასტად გავუშვებ მეთქი. თუმცა რა ურეკავდი, ახლა მაშინ ვიცოდი, რომ მაგის მთარგმნელი არ ვიყავი. ხა არ ვიცოდი რამდენი ხანი გამოვიდოდა. ეს 9:00 საათს ვარაუდობდი და 9:00 საათის თარგმნა დადება, მოკლედ არა არ შემეძლოა. მე 1 საათი ვილაპარაკეთ. და ახლა აი ამ საუბარს გთავაზობთ კიდევ ერთხელ, იქაც მაგითი ვიწყებ, მაგრამ ნუ აქვე გეტყვით, რომ ბოდიში რომ ინგლისურად არის, არ მოგეთხოვებათ რომ ინგლისური იცოდეთ, ცხადია, მაგრამ არჩევანი მქონდა რომ ან გამეკეთებინა ინგლისურად და ესე ბონუსად დამედო რომ ვინც იცის შეიძლება იმანი кайფოს, ან საერთოდ არ გამეკეთებინა და ნუ ვფიქრე გავაკეთებ რა, თუ არ იცით ინგლისური ან დაგეზარებათ 1 საათით ჩემი ჯლოყინის მოსმენა, არ მოისმენთ, ეგ იქნება. მაქვს უკვე ფაილი. აჰა, მოისმენთ.
So I will start with housekeeping and address my listeners. The first of all, I will, well, they have probably heard it, the short introduction where I apologize for the interview being in English because, well, usually my podcast is in Georgian and nobody is obliged to speak English in Georgia, but I had an option between having this conversation in English or not having it at all because I'm not going to translate like half an hour. So like the yeah. young people say, hashtag sorry, not sorry. So when is that? And the second part is that our conversation is not so you shouldn't start just listening to that. I recorded 3 episodes about the history of National Bolsheviks and the breakup of the Soviet Union, where I heavily borrowed from Fabrizio's book, so you can go listen to that. And also, if you want to have like a general info about the book, where the idea came from, about the methodology and such, you can Google New Books Network, Fabrizio, and you can find it easily. It's a podcast made by real professionals, unlike me, I'm a clown, but you know, they know their stuff and it's interesting and it goes much more into the background and the overall thing about what the book is and such. And the third is that, like, go read the book, it's available everywhere. So that was my short introduction, just to make sure that we're not still covering the bases, because you talked a lot on that podcast about what the book was about, and I see no point in like doing it again. So I want to start from the end. The book came out like 2 years ago, right? Or maybe a year and a half ago, and a lot has changed since then. Well, one thing is that Limonov died, but more importantly, this whole invasion of Ukraine by Russia has been going on for 201 days now. And is there something that you would like to add to the book if it was to come out now? Either like fate of one of your characters or what they were doing, or just to just, you know, maybe there is something in the book that explains of this madness that is happening in that part of the world.
Yes, of course. Thank you for the question, and thank you. Then you can decide whether to cut this off or. But I'm very flattered that you devoted some episodes of your podcast to the book, and even a few of them. And I will be curious to hear your perspective on it. So on the it's kind of a, of course, a complicated and controversial issue. Of course, a lot has changed, and I think that maybe one thing that has changed that I guess from anyone's perspective, well, one thing that has changed from the point of view of the researcher is that I can't go back to Russia for some time, and so that kind of gives me a little bit or deprives me of a close-up perspective to the political situation, on the political situation there. So that's one thing. In terms of the whether I should add anything to the book, in a way, I was one thing that changes in terms of when I wrote the book is that, in a way, because of the sort of highly aggressive imperialist war that is going on right now, the National Bolshevik Party, even notwithstanding its past, cannot really because of kind of some of the support for imperialist ideas that it had in the past, cannot be in any way kind of represented as a purely countercultural or subversive organization. So that's definitely sort of a question of, in a sense, image and rhetoric and aesthetics, right? So that's, and whereas in my book, that side, the kind of countercultural, subversive, protest, the dissenting side of the movement is highlighted more because it's historical, because that's what happened in the 90s and later in the Putin era, in the sense that the MBP was quite pioneering in that sense. I wouldn't change anything, even considering this completely unexpected, the war in Ukraine. I think that it was unexpected for many specialists around the world. So I'm not ashamed to say that I didn't expect it. I didn't think that it was going to happen. I wouldn't change much in the sense that when I wrote the book, I knew that I was trying to do, on the one hand, kind of combining a kind of ethnographic approach to the community. So being careful about the present. And when I did my ethnography, my interviews and such, it was 2015. So the first Ukrainian war, so to speak, was already going on. The annexation of Crimea was already happening. There had been an alignment on Limonov's part, or a partial alignment, with Putin's politics, at least as far as the Ukrainian question was going. So there was an awareness of the evolution. And in writing the book and in the style of the book, I tried, and I was aware of how fast things change in Russia and radically in Russian politics. So my attempt was to try to kind of look at a long-term perspective and thinking, okay, I want to write something that is going to be valid in terms of my assessment of the project, the community, its aesthetics, its trajectory, and so on and so forth, that it's going to be valid more or less no matter what.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be and also trying to kind of maintain a certain neutrality is, of course, impossible, but I guess an awareness of my perspective as a researcher, or positionality, as anthropologists would call it.
And the last time that the name Limonov came up was, for me, was maybe 2 weeks ago, because there was a video of, at first it was said that it was a performance in a Moscow theater of a soldier who was holding a skull in his hand and saying that this was one of the defenders of Mariupol, and addressing them, saying that we will kill you all because we're not fighting the people, we are fighting the idea, and so we will have to kill everybody who carries the germ of the idea. And then, like 2 days ago, they were saying that this is not Moscow, this is Donetsk, and that's not a real skull, because the guy who is doing the performance is Limonovits, so he's doing this whole clever Shakespeare, like Hamlet allegory, which he wasn't doing. Like, that was a horrible performance, but it was just still funny how the name Limonov still carries something, even though the guy has been dead for like a year and a half now, or maybe a year, and National Bolsheviks haven't been under that name for like a decade now, but they still matter, right? Like, what is it that the name Limonov carries on even after so long?
Yeah, that's a good question. For me, that's a good question. I think that Limonov himself, I think it's a little bit of a separate case compared to the NBP, in the sense that he has a kind of literary legacy that's not been fully figured out because of the because of the political side of his the often controversial political side of his project. The fact that in the West, by say Russian or immigrants from the former Soviet countries or former Soviet Union, he embodied and was quite important as an author. But at the same time, then he was kind of vilified because of his warmongering attitude in the 1990s. His quasi-fascist fascination and so on and so forth. So he was first kind of worshipped in the West by in different ways, or created scandal and was worshipped, then was kind of vilified. So in a way sort of deleted, kind of removed from literary history. Mm-hmm. So the history stories. And so I think that there's that sort of literary side. Even I, if I can sort of add a sort of personal attitude toward the author, I have to say that in a way, sort of, I felt like a kind of slightly rediscovered Limonov after his death as an author, in the sense that as a writer, he was very, I think, in many ways, very unpleasant and difficult to read. And when I studied him and analyzed him for my book, I did it not looking so much at his merits as a writer, but more at his influence in the sense of sort of a political community.
But you like the writings, right? Because like after Eta Yaidzichka, like I saw some of his obituaries, and they were often very dismissive of his later work. Like I haven't read, like I just read Eta Yaidzichka in the 90s. I haven't read anything else. But when I was reading your book, I had the impression that You like those books, right? Like those are well written. Whether you agree with the idea or not, that's another thing. But
well, or badly written.
Okay,
badly written in the sense that well, or maybe they're, what I would say is there's some, and other scholars did that too, so made that point too, in a way that they're bad. So that maybe their originality in part is in the fact that they're not well written in a traditional sense.
Yes.
And also, you know, for me, really, in terms of the fascination with Limonov, because in relation to the book, my initial interest and fascination was, yes, in part of the book, I found them interesting, but I found particularly interesting the kind of reception that they had, the kind of specific readership that they found, the fact that there was, they kind of, motivated very kind of opposing views, right? Literary critics at that point, when I started my book in the early sort of 2011-12, it was sort of literary critics. For literary critics, Limonov didn't exist. For Moscow teen punks, he was an idol. So that kind of conflicting views, I think it was kind of, in a way, I think that readership, right? Reading is an experience that goes two way, can't just be a genius isolated genius. So that was, in terms of the dismissing of the later part, it's fascinating. This goes more into the literary side of the project. I mean, there's the whole story of the fact that Limonov, for years after the 90s, right, he kind of took distance from Eta Yaidzichka because everyone was asking him questions about those scandalous homosexual scenes of homosexual love, and so he forbade the republication of Eta Yaidzichka. That was his most famous novel. After the 90s, it was not ever republished in Russian until his death. It was actually published Eta Yaidzichka just right now. Interesting enough, I got the copy of the book because it was also a good edition in Russian. And I was thinking, it's so crazy that this, well, now that there is this sort of kind of a reactionary or conservative mainstream in Russia, that this very, very, very reactionary conservative turn is happening, that there is, okay, understandably, maybe a sort of reappropriation of Limonov, but at the same time that this novel, which is quite subversive for definitely today's morality in Russia, from what I can see from mainstream media. It's republished and people are talking about, you know, congressmen from the Duma are talking about it in positive terms. So so there's that. And then there's the political side of it, I think, because he was a controversial figure again, but again, it's kind of, I think that what is interesting and that makes him, in a way, sort of to an extent makes him alive and for better, makes him relevant for better or worse, is that he's both politically and literary an unresolved figure. No. So there's, people didn't completely figure it out even after his death.
You have met him, right? Like, you don't have it in your book, I think, but you have a picture taken with him in your obituary that you wrote. What was your take on the guy? Because, like you said, he was a controversial figure, and my understanding from a lot of what I've read was he could be quite unpleasant. Like, he gave strong reactions to the people because of his, I don't know, attention-seeking or just this whole persona. Did you like him or... Mm-hmm.
No, it's a good question. I wrote, and it was not an easy encounter. I wrote about it when he died, and you know, I kind of was able to elaborate on the encounter later. And I didn't try to. It was at the very beginning of my research. I didn't try to meet him again throughout my research, because later on I decided that I was more interested in seeing what the community of people in the NBP was than he himself as a figure. So in a way, what his literature had produced in terms of an audience and a readership than his own sort of narcissistic, egocentric, narcissistic, egocentric side of it. And the encounter was not easy. And as later on, at the time I was... a PhD, a graduate student, and I managed to get an interview with him. I went to his apartment, and he was quite despondent. He was quite arrogant. He had an opportunistic side to him. Mm-hmm. So I think that when he discovered that there was not a major media coverage related to the project, he kind of lost interest. And he did what then I discovered was a little bit of his... a kind of repertoire that he had with scholars often. So he would say, he would answer every question saying, I don't know about this. I've never heard about these theories. I didn't go to Yale. So that was I didn't go to Yale. And then, you know, it was his repertoire. So if anyone was kind of connected to any academic institution, and maybe there was some weird kind of inferiority complex in that, because he was a poet that was never fully accepted or never fully kind of canonized. So it was like, he didn't go to Yale, didn't go to Sorbonne, I didn't go to Harvard. I'm a man of action. I like to go to the streets and fight and get into brawls. I don't care about your theories. So at some point the interview went on a little bit, and actually parts of it were, We kind of recently came out. I had an interview with the Swiss radio and came out with an Italian translation. So he's kind of, some of his answers were there in Italian, though we're lost in translation. And but yes, so it was quite it was not easy. And definitely he it was, as a figure, he was quite, as a figure in the sense of his kind of the making of his public persona, he was quite weird and unique in the sense that he tried to attract attention. He had this hyper narcissistic attitude, and at the same time he kind of was not a likable person publicly. So, and to finish the anecdote, to give another example, I gave a lecture in Italy, and there was a journalist in the audience, a quite older established journalist, was in his 60s or 70s, and we were talking at the beginning, and he said, well, you know, I interviewed Limonov, and he's the only person in my career where after 10 minutes of the interview, I got up and said, you know, whatever, bye, I'm not interested to hear this shit. So, and I said, yeah, I sympathize. So I guess it was a common... He was better from what I hear. So that there was this kind of duplicity in the sense of his public presentation and his kind of close relationship with people, because I met various people who were close to him who instead had a very different perception or perspective of him, even scholars, older scholars, and who kind of were quite fond of him. But he was sneaky in a way, to use an informal term in terms of his...
Yeah, he seemed like that. Like, how I found your book was that I asked a question myself after the war started, how can subversive figures like the punks that I used to admire go into the service of the imperialist aggressive country? And I actually started with Schnur, Leningrad. I don't know if you heard them.
Yes,
I used to listen to them. Like, I don't listen to much Russian rock, but I had the records. I used to enjoy them. And then I thought, like, what's the matter with the guy? Like, what happened? Is it money or something? And then I remembered Limonov because I have read it, I.I. Zichka, when I was young, a teenager. I didn't like the book, but it was impressive. Like, I haven't read like American authors that he was influenced by, so it was my first foray into such kind of literature, so I remembered it. And then I started researching Limonov, and then that's how I found your book. But the question that I have is still remaining, because Limonov and the other people who were in Natspoli and how it was in the 90s, those were punks, right? Those were counterculture listeners or artists or whatever, and they came to the point where they are supporting something that the counterculture should not support at all. So,
yeah,
so I'm thinking, is this like a logical progression? Is it a Russian thing, or what's going on there?
It's an interesting question, I think. And I think it's an interesting question. I think it is a little bit of a mystery that needs to be kind of unsolved, needs to be solved or unwrapped. And in the case of Schnur too, because I think that Schnur, I also agree, he was a kind of iconic, and I mean, in his music, and Leningrad in the 90s, they still are so important. And even in his later pop YouTube incarnation, I think he was quite brilliant and hilarious. And I know for a fact that he's a quite intelligent and educated person, friend with the prominent scholars like Alexander Etkin and so on and so forth. So, but I think it's a mix because, well, for one thing, it depends on the people, but it depends on the individual. So I think that, so there's an exception to all of this discussion, which is Dugin, who in his kind of becoming this absolute unquestioning instrument of Putin's, like the nastiest and most violent and bloodthirsty sides of Putin's regime. I mean, he was more consistent in that. He started with that whole sort of, we try to be part of the system, sort of we accept the Putin system in order to revolutionize from the inside. That's the story that the Eurasianists told themselves back in the 2000s. But I mean, he's been so enmeshed with the regime at this point, that's a little bit of a different story. And so kind of in a way, so mixing that counterculture with that sort of strange political technology and manipulation, which is a little bit of a typical Russian phenomenon. So he's a little bit on the side in terms of this discussion. But I think going back to figures who are more sort of consistently dissenting, so to speak, or on the countercultural side of the spectrum, like Limonov or Schnur, an American example of this that comes to mind, who's, I think, has some similarities, is Oliver Stone, right?
Okay, yes, he is.
Natural Born Killers. Mm. So I think, and you know, it's a, so I think that to an extent it is a typically Russian phenomenon. On the other hand, I've seen this happening with the leftist intellectuals in Italy, Western Europe, or in, to an extent, America. So it's not just about being sellouts or, as you said, money or power or influence or position. I think maybe in part it can be in certain instances, and in other instances it becomes this sort of desire to go against what is perceived as a sort of global mainstream, which mostly people kind of identify with American Anglo-Saxon dominance that is military and in terms of this, the level of popular culture, and doing a kind of a reasoning that becomes a little simplistic, in my opinion, which is since Putin goes against whatever it is, NATO or America or the American imperialism, then, and he's the only one who does it, it doesn't matter how horrible and vicious he is, we go with him. And, you know, and Oliver Stone is a good example. He was a talented director. I mean, Natural Born Killers, I rewatched it recently, 30 years later, and I think it aged well. It aged much better.
Still holds up for you, right? Yeah, I don't like it. Like, I still like the soundtrack. I had a CD of OST of Natural Born Killers, one of my favorite soundtracks ever, because it has a lot of good songs. But it was like Tarantino's screenplay, which he disowned because he didn't like how Oliver Stone treated it. So
I know. You know, and I think that Pulp Fiction also aged well. But I rewatched Natural Born Killers, and actually I liked it more than I liked it at the time. I thought it was very deeply weird,
non-narrative,
and very artsy, because it was surprising that such a mainstream movie was so kind of artsy and strange visually. And I think it has, so the fact is, you know, with Oliver Stone and others, again, this kind of, that's in part how I would explain it in terms of trying to go against, which, but I could, so I would just, an Italian word that came out in the excitement of the moment. One thing that I would add is that what is delusional of this attitude of saying, you know, I'm a leftist, the left is powerless right now, or, you know, I'm somebody who wants to change things, the status quo, and the left is powerless right now, so I go with the KGBishnik, with the KGB guy. What is, I think, really delusional is that Putin is a very neoliberal authoritarian figure, and there are other people who say that. He's very instrumental to a kind of neoliberal world order in his own way. I don't think that there's anything subversive in him. That's
no, and like one of the things that, because I liked your characters, and I had some problems with them as well. And one of the thing I told them when I was reading the book, like, come on, you're leftist punks. Don't be so hypocritical. Like when you criticize NATO or American imperialism or Vietnam or whatever, just look at what you are doing and what you're supporting in your country, because now it's Ukraine, but before that, like with that song Navalny, they were coming to fight in Georgia, like in my country, and they don't see a problem with that at all. Like, their problem is this with Western imperialism, but when Russians do it, it's sort of okay. So I don't know many American punks or counterculture icons who would go with their own country's imperialism. Like, all of them were against Vietnam, and all of them were against war in Iraq, and like, I don't know any cool rock person who would be like, okay, it's good that we're doing that, the bombing other countries. Like, I don't know, it's not even a question, just
the song you're referring to, and I also like the song a lot. I think it's the Natalia Medvedeva song, the Poyedim na Vaynu, and she has this very powerful, interesting voice. Poyedim na Vaynu. That it's quite epic. And, you know, and Moscow kids to this day like it a lot. She has this romanticizing of Abkhazia or former Yugoslavia war zone. So the premise is, I think, that geopolitically there's no rational explanation to it. The whole, and even if you look at the lyrics of the song, and again, it's not to justify it.
Yeah, but, sure. Like, you know, I like the song as well. Like, it's objectively a good song.
So, but the whole romanticizing is really rational in the sense that the whole thing, it's like, you know, you don't distinguish between your friend and your enemy. And, you know, it's like the war zones of Abkhazia or former Yugoslavia are like the streets of Moscow, which are lawless and you're kind of powerless. And so I think, you know, Medvedeva did say this is a biographical thing that might be quite funny to relate. is, I remember, you know, Limonov with all his more or less explicit bisexual tendencies unclear to he, but he, I think, you know, when I think about Limonov, I think he might have been one of the that's a difficult, complicated thing to say because I don't know. It's difficult, yeah. And he was not very explicit in that. But I definitely think that if he was bisexual, he was fully bisexual because he definitely loved some women. And one of them was this Natalia Medvedeva, right? She's, I don't remember which, and now I'm losing count of what number wife she was, third or something.
Yeah.
But he was interviewed at various points about her in Russian television, and I remember. He was quite in that kind, that sense. He was kind of, he elicited sympathy because he was a little kind of desperate and clueless, and was saying, you know, I was full, like deeply in love with her. And he never said that so explicitly about a woman. I loved her so much, but she was too crazy for me. Which, coming from Limonov,
yeah, it is weird.
So, and Medvedeva, you know, was a crazy, like, you know, model, punk, completely sort of. She left Limonov for this guitarist of this heavy metal band,
Corrosio Metalla, yes.
The Corrosio Metalla, and then she died of heroin addiction. So she was really this, like, living the punk lifestyle to the extreme. So in that way, there's celebration of war, and in her case, this is clearer than in others, is such an extreme sort of anarchist kind of destructive thing that it doesn't even, I mean, it's, again, it's not either good or bad. It's just that it's not kind of supporting any specific political position in that sense. That's that's the geopolitical side of things that maybe is a little bit difficult to. So one thing that maybe, and then I don't know if you want to keep this or cut it out in the sense that it might be not relevant or not that interesting, but I don't, in geopolitical terms, and this is a very difficult sort of question historically, so I don't know. It's not something that I have an answer for. But in comparison with what was, so that of the 90s, the Soviet Union or Soviet Russia, if you want to take Russia, or Moscow, Soviet Moscow, since it was such a centralized system, was a collapsing empire. And it's, you know, it's manifestation of violence. I think it was that sort of chaotic. It seems to me that it wasn't following a precise plan. It's not that it is following a plan right now, but there is kind of a dislike. So anyway, so that might be too difficult to include, so to speak.
Yeah, it is hard because it has so many different parts to it. And I wanted to go towards, like, I named my podcast series Sympathy for the Demons because, like, I didn't like the guys, but I looked at them with sympathy, and especially the first part of the book in the 90s with Kuryokhin and Letov, who I actually like both. And I haven't heard of Kuryokhin before reading the book, and then I just tried to look up on YouTube this whole Leninism mushroom thing, and he's just so likable. Like, he seems crazy. Like, his eyes are crazy, and he just goes on with his performers for an hour. And then I saw his musical performance on NTV's, what was it called, like, Musikalny Ring? And then I remember that I saw it as a child because I used to watch that. We used to get, like, Russian television in 88 or 87 or what was it. And I just remember, like, I didn't like the music that much, but I, like, they were barefoot, and then one of the audience members is asking them questions, and the first one is that, why are you dressed this way? Like, I understand this whole performance, but why are you not wearing any shoes, and why do I have long hair? And he had this whole band, like, Tsoi was playing on a guitar, and some other, I guess, you know, prominent Russian musicians of the day who I don't recognize. So that was my, do you think he was joking to the end, like it was one of his performances aligning with the Nuts balls, or did you really, really like Dugin that much? That
that's so. I agree with you. Kuryokhin, both Kuryokhin and Letov was a darker character, yeah. But definitely Kuryokhin, and definitely Timur Novikov, this leader of the New Academy in St. Petersburg. They were such kind of uber performer, hyper performers. I think I always, writing the book, I always regretted that I had never gotten a chance because they died, Kuryokin in 96 and Novikov in 2001. They must have been such incredible people to, and Kuryokin was just, you know, a one-man show. That's what how we're describing. He was just this kind of hyper performer and producing these performances all along. And so, and I write about this a little bit in the book with them too. Of course, the thing is that it's difficult to predict what they would have done later. You know, Novikov had this, but he was embittered and dying of AIDS. So he had this moment where he was supportive of Putin, but it was just really the last time, the last moments of his life. So
but later distanced himself from there, right? Like, because he was alive when Natspoli went, like, he was there for like a couple of years, and then he tried to play down his, I'm talking about Letov, right? He he was one of the founders, but then I guess he wasn't very proud of it. So I think that's one of I don't know.
With Letov, let's start with Kuryokin. And I explained this a little bit in the book, but with Kuryokin, the thing is he had this fascination for performance, in the hyperbolic performance. Mm-hmm. So Pop Mechanica, what you're describing, his band, he was, and as a musician, because he was an experimental musician, he was putting together all these people and doing this carnival at all these different very famous musicians, Soy, Grebenchikov, others, and Sergei Letov, the brother jazz guy of Yegor too. And you know, they were doing this music that was absolutely chaotic, and he was thinking about doing this sort of Gesamtkunstwerk, this sort of total work of art. And he quite consciously, there is definitely a tendency towards job, right? This kind of dark irony and over-identification with Lenin is a mushroom. He was saying, you know, this is going to be now the best form of art. He said that he would make these kind of manifestos or statements. So saying, now the best form of art is television, and this is what I'm doing. So I do mystification through television. And then the best form of art is politics, and I want to do the most radical things. And so I go with the National Bolsheviks. And then he was saying, I'm a fascist. He was saying, I'm a romantic artist, so I'm a fascist, because that's the natural thing to do. And so with Kuryokin, the thing is, of course, it's difficult to say what he would have done, but I think it was a mix of hyper-performance and true belief. There was something in him that was truly disappointed with the sort of neoliberal or liberal transition of Russia, that made him so politically, that made him to an extent provocatively, but also, and he was embraced even fascism, right? Even sort of the most radical ideas. And he, from what one can hear from testimonies of his wife and acquaintances, he was truly, he really felt close to Dugin, and he felt an affinity with him, as strange as it might seem. And with Letov, it's complicated in the sense that, yes, it's true that he distanced himself later, but it was he distanced himself mostly because there was kind of disagreements in terms of his participation, disagreements with Limonov that often would happen, as you said, because of his difficult personality. But Letov, in fact, even to an extent more consistently than Kuryokin, I guess both Kuryokin and Letov paradoxically were making statements that were even more extreme than the National Bolsheviks in terms of supporting and even encouraging political violence. Letov was saying we should be more violent, more extreme, and more radical. And of course, there was this punk radical side to him. But I do think that there was some sort of strong reaction to what was happening in the country at the moment, even if.
But he started even before, right? Like Sergiot Poplano is, I think, from 1988 or 87. It's like it's before the breakup of the Soviet Union. He was protesting Perestroika already, because I don't know why, like, what do you think, like, plus massive мир победил means? Because I also, like, mentioned it in my podcast, and then my friend wrote me and said, like, she's writing a dissertation about that period of Soviet Union, and she, I tried to read it as just pure hyperbole, like I said, plus massive, the mirror, the world of plastic is like nothing is real, and they have won. But she was saying that it's also so because of Gorbachev's reforms, or even before that, when they started to actually produce plastic more and not focus on that. So I was thinking maybe that was that was also relevant, but I was thinking maybe it could be both.
Yeah. But and but your friend, she's as a historian, she's looking at not at the Siberian punk in particular, because that would be interesting. because that's I'm not Siberian punk and the say Гражданская оборона is something that is tangentially connected to the book, but I'm not analyzing it closely. And Lietov, you know, is a literary figure because of his lyrics. He's been now studied in Russia. It's very kind of highly considered as a creative, especially a creative writer, especially because of the lyrics of his song. The Plus Plus of Emir, again, I think, and he writes that at various points, he had quite extreme experiences. You know, he was a brilliant musician and writer, but he had quite an extreme life, and he writes about this. He was sent to a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah, forcibly. And it's also like was 87. It was the tail end of the Soviet Union. It wasn't like the 84. I think it was during Gorbachev's time already when he was sent to psikhushka.
I mean, there were still people in the 80s, definitely dissidents, who I don't know if they were sent right there at that moment, but. And you know, with the Soviet Union and Russia, I think there's also a huge difference between what was happening in the capitals, quote unquote, and the provinces, in the sense that who knows how different places would deal with it. But yes, he was sent again to psikhushka, to forced psychiatric hospital, and he was forced to take these horrible psychotropic or psychoactive medications that he didn't need. So he went through some tough stuff, even in terms of sort of insanity, right? So yeah. And a lot of his lyrics, so Plastmasov Mir, the plastic, the world made of plastic as one. And I again, translating it into English for the quotes that I had in the book was fascinating, because it's such a dense but also modernist cryptic text that is difficult to say what he was literally meaning. What I know is that what my sense was that, well, for one thing, there is this sort of romantic surrealist right approach to it that he had, and he quotes the futurists, he quotes kind of the surrealist movement, and he, for which, you know, it's this sort of kind of disillusionment with the world outside, the outside world, right? Your imagination versus the outside world. But definitely for the Natsboli, and I remember one of them, the older generation, who said, you know, we used to talk with quotations from Igor Lietov. That's how much he meant for us. But then I had younger kids who would say, Plastmasov Mir Pavidil, it's kind of the world made of plastic as one, was kind of this leitmotif. They would say it all the time. And for them, yes, I think that it did also kind of captured that kind of clash with reality and disillusionment, but definitely was also kind of connected in that sense with that transition to capitalism, this thing that they felt and they perceived as so foreign and so inauthentic, so to speak.
Yeah, I was like, the track came out maybe a month ago. It's a Russian rapper, Slava KPSS, aka Gnoyny, who I knew from like rap battles with Oxymiron. But anyway, like, and half of his, I don't listen to it much, so I looked up on Rip Genius to understand what he was talking about. I speak Russian, but I didn't get the references. And half of it was like Permanentne Suicide. It was like all references to Letov. And I was like, oh, wow, like, because the guy is like 25, maybe. I don't know how old is he, but, and he's a rapper. He's not a punk rocker. So I guess He's still relevant.
Yes, I listened to some Maxime Iron and Slava KPSS a little bit because of that that rivalry that they had. And I mean, they're both. It's fascinating how literary they are. So, did that make sense? That they
it does. Like they shouldn't be, but they have all these weird references to Dostoevsky and like
Pushkin, right? Yeah. In search of what do we mean for this country? In that sense, I guess there is a little bit of a logocentric. It's a very traditional. Weirdly enough, Russian rap is a very traditional literary form, right? They have an Oxymiron. I mean, Oxymiron has some fascinating lyrics. They do, yes. This is a little bit of a digression, but even I think another figure that you're right. That means that Lietov is definitely relevant in Russia. And they had, you know, RGGU. Mm-hmm. Russian State University for the Humanities, they had some conference about Lietov and people writing about him, doing that sort of interpretation or literary analysis. And it's definitely relevant. Another, I think, pop figure in Russia that is also very literary and postmodern and sophisticated in her references, she's Manetochka, I think.
I haven't listened to her.
I highly recommend. Yes.
Okay.
She's very funny, too. She has a lot of stiob and irony in her that definitely seems peculiar, yes. But I'll check out Slava KPSS, and I had listened to some of it, but it was...
It's called Roskomnadzor, like it's about the censorship in Russia, because he's supposed to say like permanentne suicid, but he say permanentne Roskomnadzor, like stuff like that. It's kind of funny, yes. And one thing that I noticed that of what happened to Natspoli and to that crowd, I think the parallels can be made of what I have seen on online communities, when you have Stjob, and in case of 4chan or like something awful forums, they had lulls or trolling or whatever the new inword is, where there are guys who make homophobic jokes and racist jokes and misogynistic jokes, not because they are homophobic or racist, but just because they're like, you know, it's funny and it's... they didn't say triggering the libs back then, but that was the same point, right? Mm-hmm. But then you see like... but then this whole area attracts racists and homophobes and misogynistic people, and then there's the other people who are just joking, doing for this job or for the lulz. They're either going with the flow or they have to leave the area, and now it just becomes, you know, racist and homophobic and misogynistic. And then I was asked, like, I think that's what it is happening, but then I was asking myself, how much does the intent matter? Like, if you're saying N-words or saying all women should be in the kitchen or whatever jokingly without meaning it, does it matter that you're not meaning it if you're I don't know, like creating the environment where that thrives?
But
also I think that these type of environments are useful because of subversion, and because like if everybody falls in line and everybody's politically correct, or not even politically correct, but just correct in general, then nothing happens, right? Like you said, Letov probably wouldn't be my friend and I wouldn't agree with him on anything, but the music is really good, and maybe that's because that he was slightly off. Right, so I was thinking like the balancing, that on one side you have to be somebody has to be subversive and even like step outside the norms and comfort zones, but then you watch them and like in a year it just becomes like, well.
I know what you mean. So one way that I tried to put it, because I was dealing with a lot of this in different forms looking at the trajectory of some of the characters in my book, was to say, talking about this Russian concept of stjob, right, irony or parody through our identification. I was saying in certain cases, say maybe in the case of Dugin, it's a good example. You know, you have a situation where you say, you know, I play the reactionary, I play the mystical, crazy Nazi philosopher, and then, or whatever, or the fascist, and then at some point I become it. I play it so much. And there is, the idea of performativity has this side to it, right? That you kind of transform or appropriate something, and then at some point that something transforms me or transforms you. It's kind of a mutual relationship. So it's kind of you live, I think you live whatever you're performing, you live in that dialectic of sort of transforming the meaning of the words and symbols you're using and being transformed by them. So that's kind of part of what I think you're describing. And it is fascinating, maybe even in a perverse way, how this was, in that sense, was happening in Russia much earlier because of this kind of neoliberal end of history moment of the 1990s, and how, say, in the United States, it was happening just in those internet communities preceding, say, Trump's election. So one thing that I would say is, for one thing, it depends on the context. So one example where I think people, it doesn't seem like they became reactionary or racist or misogynist, is groups or audiences surrounding Laibach, right? The Slovenian. So they remained in that sort of alternative, provocative, I think in an interesting way. It doesn't seem that any of the followers are actually turning into Nazis, so to speak, right? Even if they were provocative. So one thing that is important that in what you're describing is that, for one thing, we don't create a norm, right? We can't say it's right to do this or it's right to do that. And there is also the question that I think that people seem, a lot of the time when people are talking about this, seem to either ignore or forget about, is that, okay, so if these, say, reactionary performers, right? There are some of them in America, in the United States too. If they're transgressing a norm that is perceived as coming to the left, from the left, or I guess a sort of the liberal mainstream, as you would call it, then the question is that there's something for which, before these transgressors come, that our side, if we are a political side on the left or sort of however you want to describe it, has been normalized. There's a moment where America is a little bit specific because, again, the left never truly existed. So, I mean, or it was not very relevant for a very long time. So it was much more kind of liberalism in a very broad sense. But even sort of in Italy, it's not very, or Western Europe, I think it's not very different. I mean, when it's, again, Russia is a different story. But so there is a moment where the people or sort of the groups who are this kind of mainstream, right, broadly conceived, that is the target of this conservative reactionary transgression, in a way, it must be perceived, it is perceived as normative and a bit conventional, a bit stale, a bit boring. So the question is, and even politically, the fact that a lot of the ideas and agenda and questions that and topics that should be the center of leftist politics have been appropriated by populists, right-wing populism in Europe. It means that the left also is politically failing at something before these transgressors come. So again, the question is at that point. It is true that there is, so, and the question is again, and at that point also the question comes to the idea of sort of transgression as a strategy. So the fact that this transgression has been appropriated by reactionary figures and that sometimes it translates into unsavory racist or misogynist expressions of racism or misogyny, does it mean that all sorts of transgressions or irony or ambiguity need to be dismissed, right?
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
So in that sense, I think that there is a little bit that we're a little bit of in a kind of impasse politically right now, right? Because it seems like there is no, and some I know some scholars and friends who also describe this in similar terms, that there is a little bit of a sort of it seems that like there's an alternative to either like, accept everything as like, the status quo completely as it is, or going with the reactionaries, which hopefully shouldn't be the case, right? There should be a third option.
And my last question is sort of related to that. When I was trying to talk about Natspoli, I didn't want to either oversell them or undersell them, because on one side it's kind of easy to make, if you know this meme when the guy hits the domino and the bigger domino falls, so you could have like the smaller domino, 1993 Yeltsin shells White House, and the biggest domino be like Trump is elected in White House in America, because you could make argument that this whole right-wing or neo-right, whatever, started in Russia and then moved to America, which would probably not be right, but one could make that argument. So I think maybe this is also something that you struggled in your book. On one hand, you're writing about the guys who had an impact and still have an impact, but on the other side, you want to be fair, right, and not over-exaggerate of the impact that they had. Because, like, when I looked at their demonstrations on YouTube, it was mostly a couple of hundred people at best. So it wasn't a lot of people, like you write, but they were very dedicated and committed, and they did leave a mark on Russia. And did they also leave a mark on France, I guess, or Italy or America as well, or it's just contained to former Soviet Union? What do you think?
Well, I think it's complicated, and it varies slightly in the sense that they left a mark in terms of protest culture in Russia for sure, because not just because they were very active and very committed, but because I think in those 2000s, the 2000s in the sense of the first decade of the 2000s, there was this moment of general passivity, and the Natsboli, National Bolsheviks at that point, they had weirdly, because of Limonov inconsistency or consistency, however you want to look at it, they had become sort of part of this anti-Putin coalition and sort of kind of street avant-garde of the liberal opposition. So they were this strong presence in the media in terms of expression of dissent and in terms of kind of this kind of self-martyrdom that they cultivated, both in terms of an image and in terms of lifestyle, in the sense of being ready to go to prison, being abused, and so on and so forth. So there's that in terms, and you know, if you look at Vaina, right, the art collective Vaina, or Pussy Riot later, they all talk, Talakonnikova talks about Limonov all the time, all the Vaina guys. And Vaina was also strange, had some, you know, these are all, these are not just groups, but also individuals. So I guess they're, opinions differ, of course, but there were elements of Vaina that had some imperialist side to the ideas and ideologies, so that's present too. But definitely they were, I think, influenced by the MBPezan experience as a kind of political platform, a creative political platform in the sense of rethinking ideology, reimagining ideology, and expressing dissent, no matter what that would be. In a moment in which in Russia dissent was not widely expressed, right? So that's for, in that sense, in the sort of global context, I think that in a way it is a little bit different in the sense that, well, so I agree with you. It is, everything is connected, and at the same time, it's not just a sort of relation of causality, right?
Yes.
1993 happens, Trump is elected. I mean, those two questions, I think that globally, not even geopolitically, but globally in terms of both American culture and Russian culture, those two events are very connected, that you mentioned are historically very connected in terms of the disillusionment with the Democratic Party in the United States. That, you know, that at the time of Clinton was not happening, but was definitely happening in Russia. So there is definitely a kind of echoing of ideas there historically. In terms of the NBP itself and its participants and its aesthetics and its strategy, and especially in the form of this kind of red-brown ideology, so this kind of populist right-wing, left-wing reaction and rebellion against again what is perceived as a sort of global neoliberal consensus. There is an impact in the sense that that this is something that that is very relevant today in many countries, at least that I can think of in the Western hemisphere, in Western Europe.
But it's also because of Dugin's figure, right? Because Dugin is easier to sell to the West because he looks like this crazy Russian mystic, Zagadochnaya Ruskaya Dusha representative, and he's also good in promoting himself as Putin's ideologue, even though there are serious questions about whether he's anybody's ideologue or just, you know, self-promoting crazy guy with a beard.
Absolutely, he's not at all. He's not at all. Of course, he's much more fringe than Putin, and he's not at all his ideologue.
And most of his ideas, from what I understood from your book, are taken from some French philosophers that I hadn't heard before, and some of them are alive, and some are what, either Wikipedia them. Some of them are like French right-wing journalists, and they're, yes, I guess, much more eloquent because French have their own like thing with this language and whatever. Like, I don't speak French, but that's the impression that I get from them. So my take on Dugin was that his ideas are not that much original or his own, and he's not that much influential in Russia, except like his network. But he's quite influential in Georgia because I guess he's one of the go-between, like, I cannot prove anything, but that's widely known that he's an intermediary between Georgian nationalist groups and Russian, I don't know, whoever gives them money, but it goes through Dugin, mm-hmm, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah. I don't know if his writings then resonate in Europe as well, or maybe not, because who reads those? Like, it's kind of hard to read, I guess.
Well, yes, that would be very, very fringe right-wing, radical right-wing minority. So, no, I would say that's an influence that of Dugin that kind of occurs on two levels, I think. There is definitely that network of very, very radical right-wing ultra-nationalist groups in Western Europe and the United States, which he cultivated throughout. And he was definitely, as this, you know, with this kind of Eurasia movement and now with this oligarch Konstantin Malafiev, is definitely been used and as a channel for, say, sending volunteers to fight in Eastern Ukraine, making contacts with various nationalist organizations in Europe. So that side of his influence in terms of him being even used at a more or less institutional level, although maybe in a surreptitious way or opportunistically, mm-hmm, I think that is definitely there. In terms of, so I think that there's two things. I think he's quite, to an extent, I think he's quite popular in Russia, not straightforwardly in the sense that people know his name. You're right, he's totally not recognized. He's not such a recognizable figure as he is paradoxically in the West. In the West, now pretty much a lot of people would recognize him. I think my idea, and again, I expressed this in the book, is that he had this very active, and in that sense, he was a precursor. They were these neo-Eurasianist precursors of 4chan and various internet groups, because they started using the internet very, very early in the late 90s. They flooded the internet with these micro, more or less big websites and texts and ideas and so on and so forth. And they, I think that they had an impact in the sense that some of those buzzwords that are part of Dugin's arsenal are now more and more common in Russia. It's not just coming from him, but he had that sort of influence as well. And in terms of Western Europe, I think that it was, again, I think that most of, and you're right about that, about this, the idea of self-promotion in the sense that he was kind of promoting his image, even sort of in kind of fringe audiences and groups, and so in that way, sort of, he was able to present himself and at least to convince or in the mainstream media to be presented as this sort of, they always say the youth, they think Putin's Rasputin because of the sort of aesthetic thing. But, in terms of the ideology, it's true that it's not original, that it's a pastiche of very many things that are put together. Some of them are kind of replicated or appropriated but they are kind of put together in a very sort of postmodern way in a kind of a huge collage of things that make it something slightly different. And in a way it kind of, Alain de Benoist is one of these kind of members, leaders of the French New Right, who Dugin was strongly influenced by. Stoikers, who was a Belgian, also far right, kind of connected basically to neo-Nazism quite straightforwardly. So he's appropriating these ideas, but on the other hand, in that sense, the legacy of the MDP has some significance in the sense that, in a way, he's kind of transforming a little bit these ideas through the experience of Russian counterculture and Russian dissent from starting in the 1990s. And so these ideas kind of come back on a global scale, on a sort of global stage, more with a connection with this sort of post-Soviet transition, this kind of traumatic post-Soviet transition, which is a lot what these kind of red-brown right-wing populism in the West is expressing now, because there is this kind of fascination with Russia as this sort of other, but also another that kind of resists kind of the course of modernity or whatever it is that is considered the status quo.
No. Well, thank you very much. You promised me half an hour. We talked an hour and 15 minutes. It was very, very interesting. So, well, thank you very much for your time and for your book. And I'll probably put this up on tomorrow or something and send you a link just so you have it.
Oh, and, yeah, that's great. Thank you.
So, take care and good luck with your students.
Thank you. Yeah, let's be in touch. I'm very curious. I mean, I'm sorry that I can't read or listen to the Georgian.
Not many people can, but
I know it is the I know a scholar who's been, I think, at least trying to learn it for a long time now. But definitely, I'll follow you and definitely send me the link. It was a great conversation.
Well, thank you for me as well. So, bye.
Yeah, good luck again.